one of my teachers, Master Shangyan, his approach was both one of contemplation and action. And I valued his teaching on the level of deep Dharma and insight and wisdom and the teachings of compassion. But I also valued him as a model, because it's really what I believe in terms of Dharma in daily life. So where I want to go with this is that in times like this, the path, I think, needs to be rethought. And it's not that it's not the same practice, it's not that it's not the same path, but I think we have to bring everything we know to this time period, because this time period is as demanding as it is, and for many, as distressing as it is. The teachings themselves are no different than they were in the Buddha's time. The Dharma is timeless. The Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, is eternal, and the light of the Dharma is undying. It's just as pertinent as it was when the Buddha first gave his first talk in the Deer Park in Sarnath, India. It's just as pertinent now. And why do I say that? I say that because here we are, all of us gathered together tonight. And as we know, so many Dharma centers in the United States and all over the world, so many Buddhist centers offering the Dharma. Where I am teaching for the month at the Forest Refuge in Barre, Massachusetts, right across the field, of course, is the Insight Meditation Society. That has been happening, offering retreats for 50 years. As of next year, it'll be 50 years of IMS's life. And all the retreat centers that I'm involved with have been offering retreats and teachings and classes and understandings in a sustained way for a good long time. And so pertinent now as the teachings were in the Buddha's time, so many people are interested in these things now. And why? Why are we interested? Well, one reason we're interested is because we know it makes a difference. We know. And for those of you who are totally new online here tonight, maybe to know that many people online here tonight have been practicing for a good long time and know that it changes a life. It transforms the heart. And it makes our relationships with others richer and more interesting and enlivening and beneficial. And it makes our relationship with the world more tangible and more intimate. And I think the more we practice, the more we understand. that empathy and compassion are most needed in this world. We sit and we experience the pain in our own hearts, and instead of trying to deny it or push it away, instead of getting involved in this or that and pretending that it doesn't exist, and pretending that if we just absorb into this or that, it will go away. In the discipline, the practice of staying still and doing nothing and turning towards the pain, turning towards the suffering, turning towards the grief and the angers and the sorrows and the jealousies and everything that we find within our hearts, and recognizing the ways that we believe our thoughts so fervently. And so just sitting with all of this wakes us up. It wakes us up to our own pain and to the possibilities of easing that pain, of really truly finding a way out and not being condemned to a lifetime of grief and sorrow and pain and suffering. And we begin to get a sense of, oh goodness, this is true for me. And maybe until I sat still, I didn't know even how profound my pain is. Maybe until I quieted, I didn't know that maybe there could be a way out of this pain. And quite naturally, we want that for others. Quite naturally, we start expanding our heart. And we recognize that it's not just my pain, it's our pain. It's not just my suffering, it's our suffering. And so what is the appropriate response? Certainly wisdom, a path of wisdom, a path of understanding, and a path of love and of compassion is necessary. And we see this not as something idealistic. We recognize that we want to, we have to, we aspire to living our life with compassion. So the teachings as pertinent now as they were in the Buddha's time, the teachings of the Four Noble Truths, that there is dukkha, there is fragility, there is suffering. Seeing as well that there are causes to happiness and there are causes to suffering. And when we pay attention to those causes, we can find a way out, the third noble truth. We can find real liberation within our hearts. And we know, we find that there is a path, and we are walking on that path. And without evangelizing or, you know, missionary zeal or thinking that other people don't have their own path and their own path isn't just great for them, wonderful for them. So not trying to convince anyone that this path is better. It's a path, it's not the path. But when we know any degree of happiness and joy and liberation within our hearts, compassion really comes alive. And I think of this teacher I was talking about as someone who, boy, sat and walked, lived a life of real contemplation, really truly a contemplative, and operated in the world with great compassion and care, embodied the compassion so that it wasn't just left on his cushion. And this is what I mean by rethinking the path, that it is a path to be embodied. It is a path to be lived. So, for noble truths, same as ever, not any different than ever, but they need to be applied to things as they are for them to be alive. You know, they're not just dusty old teachings that have no relevance to our lives. They help us, they encourage us to meet the conditions we are facing in this turbulent and deeply distressing, for so many, time period that we are facing, that we are in. And to bring the light of the Dharma, shine the light of the Dharma on this time period so that we can meet it with greater skill. We can meet this time period, the challenges that we are facing, with greater willingness rather than resistance. With less inner resistance and greater willingness to turn towards life as it is. So life as it is always just life as it is, right? It's always life as it is. And the conditions in life change. And so the practice is to meet those conditions, these conditions, best we're able to, and to actually live our practice, to live what we know is what has always been called for, but perhaps now to take it a little bit more seriously. It's not so easy to be complacent at this time. You know, maybe that's something different than has been so in the past. It's not as easy to avoid for those kind of prone to avoidance. It's not quite as easy to turn away from. And so, bringing our practice in means the willingness to turn towards, not avoid, the pain in the world, the pain in our hearts, the pain that our loved ones may be experiencing, the pain that we read about and hear about and are informed about, but turning towards and facing. Doesn't mean contracting. Doesn't mean forcing. Doesn't mean a big sense of I have to. We have to, right? And it's not even have to, it's wanting to. It's a willingness because of what I was speaking about before. The heart opening and being willing to include instead of to be too narrow. Instead of being tight, expanding. Instead of being as caught in our fear, facing our fear and facing our fears together. Not thinking that one is alone in this whole thing, but to connect up with those who are oriented on this path of wisdom and compassion. Whether it's Buddhist or not, doesn't matter. Connecting up with those who are yearning to live in this time period with integrity, with truthfulness, with grace, with courage. So it means looking at and getting behind an embodying of the practice of contemplation. Part of this, of course, is understanding, relaxing around what is out of our control and getting quite clear on what is out of our control. You know, because if we're pushing against that which is out of our control, we will end up feeling powerless and helpless. So to recognize that it's not a personal fault when we see that which is out of our control, it's out of everyone's control. It allows us to engage fully in the arenas where we do have great power to engage. So if we can get clear regarding our efforts to control the uncontrollable, and to get clear regarding where great inner empowerment lies, and perhaps we can meet this moment as it is and contribute as we can, and be one of many attempting to contribute as we can. So, of course, the great area that we cannot control is how other people feel. Even how other people feel about us, ourselves, we can't control. We can't control how other people act. We can't control the thoughts that other people have. We can't manage any of this. We can't control what arises. We can respond to that which arises, and that's where we have a great power that can be ever more understood and harnessed. But that which arises happens because of causes and conditions. And so we are meeting those causes and conditions from moment to moment. But the emotions that arise, they just arise. The thoughts that pop up, they just pop up. We can meet them. Our reactions to the actions and speech of others. The reactions just happen, but we can respond to those reactions, and this is where we have great power. We can understand that what is happening right now is because of causes and conditions, some of which we can know and recognize, and many of which we cannot. So instead of making a self, instead of making an other, instead of fixing ourselves as a this or that, fixating on somebody else as a this or a that, making them into a self or an other, is it possible to be here and now and relate as we can, respond as we can, look at our relationship to what's happening, rather than thinking that we have all that much power regarding what it is that is happening? When we understand this, it helps so much, because instead of futile efforts, using our efforts in ways that won't be useful or effective, that will be disempowering, that will leak energy needed for other endeavors, we can use our efforts more wisely. So, where do we have some agency? Where is the power? Where is the inner empowerment? And maybe another question is, what is possible right here and right now? What we care about, what we attend to, our response to any situation. We can guide, we can influence, we can share, we can teach when it's appropriate. We can be of benefit. Enormous power in the recognition that we can be of benefit. Enormous power in recognizing that we have the power to be kind. We have the power to encourage the wholesome. We have the power to discourage the unwholesome. We have immense power within that is untapped. We can practice the paramis that many of you are quite familiar with these days. We can practice integrity and generosity. We can practice letting go and wisdom. We can practice wise effort and patience, truthfulness and dedication. And we can practice metta, loving kindness, and equanimity. These are all powers within that we can practice and encourage and embody in our daily life at this time. The degree of presence that we offer, our availability, we can encourage ourselves to be available, to connect. And understanding this brings tremendous energy to contribute beautiful thoughts and speech and actions, peace to this precious planet that we are all living on. So this is a time to bring our contemplative life into action. And you could say that we're always doing so. You know, the moment that we get up from our cushion, we can't help but bring our contemplative life into action. It's just that sometimes we value our sitting practice over our daily life practice. Sometimes we don't see it, our daily life, as important as the forms of contemplative practice, when actually it's just another moment. And what we have learned while sitting, we can play out and live and embody in our lives. I am not gonna tell you to go out there and do something. I'm not gonna do that. I've been chatting, of course, having conversations and dialogues with fellow teachers of the Dharma, trying to help each other find our way through this time and contribute different ideas about how we can move through this time in a way that is beneficial. And I'm not going to do that because I trust you. I know this community as much as I can. And I know that many of you are already engaged, and those of you who are not, not because you don't want to be, but because of personal reasons in your life. I mean, it's always striking to me when I have a one-on-one with one of you and I hear what people are up to. So I won't do that. I won't go there. And to say that it is true that anxiety eases when we do act. I was very aware after 9/11 that those in the Sangha, those in the community who had work or jobs or were volunteering in organizations that were meaningful for them, where they felt that they were engaged and were making a difference, were better off than those who were left to just be anxious and worried. That the engagement really mattered. So even though I do trust you and I do know how much engagement is already happening, I want to offer this perspective that if you've been holding back and afraid to get engaged or all of that, perhaps just that recognition that when one is involved in meaningful engagement, particularly in groups, particularly in community, particularly with others, that the worrying is not quite so strong because you're actually engaged in something that may make a difference. We never know. We never know whether our actions are going to make a difference or not. But to engage in actions that may make a difference because they are meaningful to us, because they are moving things in a direction that is meaningful for us. This is something that eases worry, eases anxiety, and is worth contemplating. And anxiety also needs to be contemplated. It's not either or. It's not throw yourself into active engagement and forget to sit in a formal way. It's not like that. It's not either or, it's both, it's and. Anxiety also needs to be contemplated. We don't want to throw ourselves into engagement and neglect looking at our own hearts and caring for our own hearts and recognizing the torments of heart, the greed and the hatred and the delusion, what are called the kalesas, the torments of heart within ourselves. Because that is of essence, to care for our hearts. And this is something that can happen in the deepest way when we are sitting quietly and attending, turning towards the pain that is happening within. Mahagosananda said, how can ordinary people be peacemakers? How can ordinary people like us be peacemakers? And he said, just take care of yourself. Just love yourself. Be compassionate with yourself. Then you are a peacemaker. Peace begins with you. And isn't this true? Isn't this true? You know, if we've been around long enough, we see that things change in this world, and governments come in and governments go out, and people come into power, people go out of power. But if the heart does not change, and no one can be responsible for our hearts other than ourselves, if each one of us can take responsibility, can respond to our own pain and sorrow, torments of heart, and care, respond to the greed with generosity, respond to the hatred with kindness, respond to the delusion with wisdom. So it's not either or, right? But we have to respond. We have to take the thorn out of our own hearts for there to be any possibilities of peace in this world. So facing anxiety, facing all mental states directly, and seeing into their changing nature, their impermanent nature, seeing into their basically empty and insubstantial nature, seeing into the necessity of facing with love and releasing and relinquishing anything that doesn't serve the deepest of peace and happiness. With contemplation, there is greater calm and steadiness. We can come upon a basic sanity within that's underneath the neurotic patterns that we all have. More insight is possible. So I think it is a time, I have to say, when more formal practice is called for. A number of you over the last number of months have told me that you have upped your formal sitting and walking practice. Now, some of you told me that you did it at particular times regarding world events, but a number of you have told me this, and I really commend you. I really delight in hearing that and knowing that, because to me, that's wise. That's a wise action to up your formal time spent in just sitting quietly. I have a question in terms of wise action. Do you consider being well informed regarding current events to be wise action? I think that it can be wise and it can be unwise. And each one of us has to assess and look at this for ourselves and be willing to be flexible, not to decide, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that, but to be flexible and listen deeply. And that's what compassion is listening, listening deeply. And so knowing that it will change our level of being informed and being willing to change as we hear that a change is necessary in one direction or another. But it's the difference between overexposure and informing ourselves, staying in touch at a time when staying in touch is, I think, important. But I want to tell you about a 2013 study that people who consumed a lot of media about the Boston Marathon bombing experienced higher acute stress than those actually there at the marathon itself. That's pretty interesting. You know, it points to there being something about screens, because that's how we get our news oftentimes. Perhaps reading is different, but about screens, that contributes to a mind that tends to catastrophize. And we really don't want to do that right now. We really don't want to catastrophize in an environment where catastrophes are happening. So we don't want to add on via thinking. And we don't want to weaken ourselves by over-consuming the news. Those facing truly dire conditions will need us to be strong and courageous. And we don't want to weaken ourselves. For our own sake, for the sake of our loved ones, for the sake of people we don't know, for the sake of this precious planet, for the sake of the world, we don't want to weaken ourselves. So again, I'm not saying this or that. I'm not being prescriptive, because everyone is different. But just to offer you this information to use in a way that works for you. Overconsumption of the news can lead to cynicism and being jaded and numb and only worrying, which is not a help to anyone. I also wonder about sharing outrage regarding the news with others, whether it necessarily moves anything wholesome forward. Now, you know, we live with people, many of us, and I'm not suggesting cutting anybody off and shutting down or anything like that. Not at all. But to look at what might be possible. Of course, taking responsibility ourselves for our sharing of outrage, whether it actually moves the needle in a positive direction. And hearing outrage from others, you know, kind of we have to work with that in loving ways. We can't cut people off that we love, that need to talk to us, you know, where they're sharing their pain with us, really. And at the same time, maybe ways of saying, okay, you know, not now, please not now, please a little less right now. And maybe we can talk about it for 5 minutes or half an hour every day or whatever it might be for you and your loved ones or your colleagues or whomever you are talking to. It can feel like an action, but is it wise when it's habitual? You know, because of feeling helpless, it can feel like something I can do. I can share my outrage with others. And there certainly can be times when sharing your outrage with others, new ideas come about, new ways of joining together collectively and doing something that is really positive and beautiful, of course, can happen. So it's not just one thing or another. Fluidity and flexibility are so required right now. There is a deep interconnection between contemplation and wise action. Compassion is meeting the cries of this world. It's meeting the joys in this world as well, but meeting the cries in this world without a sense of separation between contemplating and acting. They work together. It's not ever just one or the other. As a human being in this world, sometimes the problem is that when we think of acting, it has to conform to very specific ideas. And actually, acting is always happening. How are we embodying what is most meaningful to us? That could be a good Dharma question. How are we embodying what is most important? We get up from the cushion and the world is here to be engaged with. It's a confusing time, and it's very easy not to know what to do. And I would just encourage listening. If you listen, compassion will motivate you, wisdom will motivate you to move in a way that is wholesome and contribute something good, something positive. The role of contemplation is to meet the torments of heart within ourselves and to render them powerless. As we take on this work of contemplation, we meet the world in less of an anxious and helpless and paralyzed and powerless way. So we are participating. We are participating. This is not on any one person's shoulders. The time of the hero or the heroine or the totally perfect one, that's not what's being called for right now. We can't wait around for someone to tell us what to do. We can't wait around for someone to be so perfect or so heroic that we can just follow in their footsteps. Each one of us needs to look within and again to ask, what is possible here and now? To participate is to be a bodhisattva, which means one aspiring to Buddhahood. Not to make this so individual, but to connect, to come together with whatever our communities might be, and to do it together. I think I've been saying this to some of you that I think it's a time to both lower our standards and raise our standards as well. You know, lower our standards because rest is really required right now. This is exhausting time, and it has its impact on the body. So perhaps more rest than usual is necessary, not to expect oneself to always be energetic or doing everything in some kind of a perfectionistic way, to lower the standards for oneself and hopefully others as well. Take care of each other rather than having unrealistic standards. And at the same time, to raise the standards, greater confidence in one's capacity to meet the moment. So I want to end with the story about my friend Mahagusananda. He was many, many people's friends, but I think everybody felt like, you know, my friend. If anyone who had an encounter with him might have claimed him as my friend, and he tended to claim everyone as his friend as well. So anyway, another time for stories about friendship. But I wanted to tell you about this. At the United Religions Initiatives Global Summit in 1997, Mahagusananda was there and beamed through the whole week without saying a word. There would be intimate groups and people would sit at the table. He would sit at the table and beam in silence and didn't say a word, wearing his orange hat in the 90 degree weather. The microphone was passed around on the last day, and it was really time for Bhante to say something. Obviously, the moment had come and it was time for him to speak. He took the microphone and sat with it for a full minute and then said, I'm waiting for a full minute here. We are all in the same boat together. And then he passed the microphone on. We are all in the same boat together. He said the truth. We know that there are some who want a bigger boat and want to throw some people out of the boat and have the boat all to themselves and for their friends. But this is impossible. It is impossible. We are all in this boat together. In the same boat. And those of us who know this need to live it, because we know it. If we didn't know it, we wouldn't have to live it. We could just do whatever we wanted to do. We could just flail around and panic and be unkind and be self-centered and look out only for ourselves and our loved ones and do anything we wanted. But we do know. I know that everyone here knows. And if you know, as we do know, we want to live it. We have to live it, right? To live it is really difficult. And this is why we need to contemplate and care for our hearts. And I'll actually end with one more story about Bhanteji. This was related by a monk named Eshin Nishimura, who said, there was little for, this was when Mahagusananda was in a refugee camp in Thailand. And he said that there was little for the Cambodian refugees to do in the camp, but I noticed a makeshift Buddhist temple made of bamboo set up in one corner of the refugee camp. And inside the bamboo temple, a single Buddhist monk sitting in meditation. This monk found out afterwards that this monk was actually Mahakusananda, this monk that he saw sitting alone in this little bamboo makeshift temple was Mahakusananda. And he said to him, "What were you doing there?" Mahakusananda said, "I was making peace with myself so that I could share it with others." Okay, let's sit for a moment together. All right, I hope that was helpful in some way or another. I do feel it's important to talk about these things and not be on so high of a plane that we aren't aware of being together in the world right now. Okay, so let's just have a few moments together, sitting quietly together. And and why we sit. Sensing the sorrow and confusions. Sensing the joys and appreciations, gratitude. It's all here. It's all here now. And sensing your connection with this community, this Sangha, this lineage, this path, this way of making sense out of that which seems impossible to understand. And yet we can, not with words, but via our hearts. Our hearts and our bodies, we can understand. So just a moment of sensing our care for each other, our appreciation. We could have done anything tonight. And here we are, wanting to be together, wanting to listen, receive, understand the real blessings of compassion. May we dedicate ourselves to living a life of wisdom. May we dedicate ourselves to embodying a way of compassion. May we dedicate ourselves to the truth, take our stand upon the truth, and not be swayed, come what may. May it be so. All right, let's wave each other. I know not everybody's going to bed, but maybe some of us are. Let's wave ourselves. All right, bye for now. To be continued, to be continued.